How did the Vietnam War change the way we think of ourselves as a people and a nation? Christian Appy, author of The Oral History of the Vietnam War Patriots, now examines the relationship between the war's realities and myths and its impact on our national identity, conscience, pride, shame, popular culture, and post-war foreign policy. Drawing on a vast variety of sources from movies, songs, and novels to official documents, media coverage, and contemporary commentary, Appy offers an interpretation of the war and its far-reaching consequences. His new book is American Reckoning, the Vietnam War and Our National Identity. He is a professor at UMass Amherst, and he will be speaking at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts on Tuesday, the 24th of February, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Christian Appy to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Joe.
It's very nice to have you here, and I so enjoyed Patriots, and what you, and that was an oral history, and what you do here is, as I mentioned in the introduction, of look at the war and how we look at it now and how it identifies us. I'm curious as to what put you on that path, what brought you, pointed you in that direction.
Well, even after all the work I had done on the subject, it just continued to bother me that we seem to have forgotten so much about the war and learned so few lessons, or the wrong lessons. I really wanted to try to recover a sense of how the war came into American life in the 1950s and how it very radically changed American perceptions of national identity in the 60s, and then how in the post-Vietnam decades we've kind of recobbled together repackaging of the war. So, yeah, I'd be happy to kind of walk you through those dramatic changes.
Yeah, so where's a good place to start?
Well, for me, it was really interesting to go back into the 50s and try to recover a sense of just how broadly Americans believed in the government to do the right thing, and how people believed that America was always and everywhere a force for good in the world, that we were the good guys, that we were always on the side of democracy and freedom, and that when our presidents told us that we were going into Vietnam to save poor Vietnamese from godless communism, was really widely shared to the extent that Americans were paying attention. I think that they believed that and did not have reasons to think otherwise, since there really was not much challenge to the official claims about the war. But that's what makes the 60s so extraordinary, because while it did take time, gradually the American public did become conscious that their government had badly distorted and even flat out lied about the origins of the war, about how it was being conducted, and our prospects for success. I mean, just to go back to, you know, this being the 50th anniversary of Johnson's massive escalation of the war in 1965, one of the things Americans didn't quite realize is that Johnson himself, in private, was very skeptical that we could be successful. He really thought it was an impossible situation, and his own advisors, most of them, were telling him that the best that he could hope for is just to avert or delay defeat, not that he could really defeat the communists, because they understood that the government we were propping up in South Vietnam really did not have the broad support of its own people. And then, too, Americans began to realize that even this idea that we were supporting democracy seemed to be fraudulent, because the government in South Vietnam was nothing like a democracy. American troops quickly picked up on that when they were over there. And they even began to learn that back in the 50s, there was to have been an election nationwide in Vietnam called for by the Geneva Accords that would have reunited the country under one government, and the Eisenhower administration prevented that election from happening because he understood from his sources that communist leader Ho Chi Minh would have almost certainly won that election by 80%. So that's when we moved in with the ambition of creating a permanent non-communist country called South Vietnam. And so, you know, this awakening, what I call this awakening of dissent by the late 60s was so dramatic that by 1971, not only did 71% of Americans say the war had been a mistake, but a remarkable 58% had concluded that the war was immoral. Mm. And I think we sort of have lost that anti-war perspective in the decades since the war, in part because the rightward shift in our country, starting really with the Reagan years in the 80s, very successfully kind of repackaged the Vietnam War as an American tragedy. And the focus was not so much on what we had done, the damage we had done in and to Vietnam and that whole history of the war, but focused instead on the damage the war had done to us and the thought that it had destroyed our unity and our pride and our patriotism and our military power. And so there was an effort to rebuild and also to kind of heal from the war. So there was, the emphasis was on healing more than history. And as a result, I think a whole couple of generations of students came of age not having the slightest idea of the basis for the public protest of the 1960s.
And as a result, you write that things change, our wake-up moment after that generational shift was 9/11.
Yes, and that, you know, there had been in the 25 years before 9/11, between Vietnam and 9/11, there had been, we were involved all over the world, but one thing it did lead to is a certain constraint on the use of force. Our leaders then at least understood that Americans would no longer tolerate a long and indecisive war with lots of American casualties. So actually fewer than 1,000 American troops died in combat in that 25-year period. But with 9/11, all of that sort of constraint and the more sort of sensible lessons of the war went out the window. And once again, we found ourselves engaging in large wars far away on false pretext that were prolonged long after the people had turned against them. Actually, polls show that by 2006, the Americans wanted to withdraw from both Iraq and Afghanistan.
I find myself asking this question a lot throughout my career of which is why don't we learn these lessons? And especially when they're, I mean, a lot of times they are apples to oranges, but sometimes they're apples to apples. And you wonder why we don't learn lessons from history. So I'm interested in that. And I'm also interested in, do you think that our perception and our identity will always be shifting in this regard, or we will eventually end up with a narrative, a defined narrative?
Well, I do remain hopeful. Otherwise, I wouldn't do this work. But it helps to have a long-term view. When you,
right.
You know, looking at a year or two, I'm pretty pessimistic because I do think that the people, the tiny elite that makes our foreign policy, haven't learned the right lessons, and largely because they all share the conviction, which is really that the conviction of American exceptionalism, that they really do believe that we are an indispensable force for good, and that we use our force for all the right reasons, and that without us there would be a world of disorder and anarchy. And I just don't think the historical record upholds that vision. So I think unless and until we can really challenge that idea that we're not so exceptional and unique in world history, we're not going to formulate a different course. And at the heart of it is, I think, really, and this is, I think, what the main lesson of Vietnam should have been, which is that foreign policy has to be more democratic. It has to be accountable to an informed public, and yet we've become ever more secret. And Congress, too, our representatives, has abdicated its responsibility in matters of war and peace. And you know, it's no accident that we haven't had a declared war since World War II. So, you know, I do think over time the public, by the way, is partly to blame, but the public actually, I think, has been much more sensible than its leaders on these issues, especially when they have when they're given information, you know, the right information and not lied to. But I also worry that the public has become inured, that's not quite the right word. They, you know, have thrown up their hands in frustration, as if believing that this big military-industrial complex has kind of taken on a life of its own and is impervious to change. And that, coupled with the fact that we rely on such a small percentage of our population to do the fighting in this volunteer force, less than 1%. It makes it possible for us to live in wartime without any consciousness of war whatsoever. We can be pretty much oblivious to it. And, you know, the media comes and goes. You know, something pops up like a beheading or ISIS, and they pay a lot of attention to it for a time. But then, you know, it falls to the back pages very quickly.
I mean, we're seeing that this morning of an ISIS hostage, Kayla Mueller, died. And that is the headline for today. And as you say, it eventually falls off the pages. But this is a case, ISIS is a case, where we are seeing there are numbers and there's great concern. And so the question that always comes out is, okay, it apparently we are not doing enough right now, but then what is the right thing to do? And that question of not knowing what the right thing to do is, coupled with the fact of when is it too late? How much time do you have to figure out what the right thing to do is?
Right. And I think the government uses that sense of urgency to just sort of leave the rest of us out of that debate. And
right.
I really think that's a mistake. I do think we need to have these discussions because it is a real problem. And this is a group, certainly brutal, more brutal than Al-Qaeda in many ways, but I do think that there has been some quite wild exaggeration about the kind of threat it poses, at least to us. And my own hope is that a regional solution is much more likely to be successful than our imposing with great force, because my fear is that it will do more simply to recruit support for ISIS, though ISIS does not strike me as a group that has broad support in the region, which is another reason to think that maybe local forces can take care of it if we don't overstep.
So
we do need that debate.
I asked a form of this question, and I just want to ask it again in a slightly different context, which is when I was asking about the national identity and when that becomes firm and when it's been written. When it comes specifically to the narrative of the Vietnam War, do you think we are there yet as to how it is explained, how it is taught,
realized? I don't at all. And one of the things that my students have internalized for good reason is that, you know, very much represented by the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, if there's anything, any landmark for them that represents the war, that's it. And they've kind of,
Absolutely. They
grow up thinking that the most important thing about the war, maybe the most shameful aspect of it, was how Vietnam veterans were treated. And it kind of feeds into this notion that our biggest responsibility as citizens in matters of foreign policy is simply to support the troops, which often takes the form of quite empty gestures of thanking them, but not providing them with the support the government really owes them. And, you know, just last year, the big Veterans Administration scandal indicated that some 100,000 veterans had been denied timely care. So I'm afraid that this, you know, it's all too easy to sort of thank the soldiers, but it would be much healthier for us to say, please tell us about your service and let's have a discussion about it. Because in my experience, and I've interviewed hundreds of veterans over the years, is that even if they have a different view of the politics than you do, and they're the one thing to remember is that veterans are a very diverse group. I mean, they're all over the map politically, as is the country. But when you talk to them, they can really give you some great insight and have experienced firsthand the discrepancies between the way wars are described and justified and the way they're actually lived on the ground. That was certainly true in Vietnam, where they were told that they would be going in as liberators, only to find out within, you know, days in country that the population largely perceived them as foreign occupiers and invaders, and that they weren't there really to protect or defend territory or people, but just out on hunting expeditions around the countryside to amass body counts. So it is important to talk to soldiers and veterans and try to bridge that divide between this huge civilian population and this very small military one. That's part of the process of creating, I think, a more democratic foreign policy.
Christian Appy is a professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His new book, American Reckoning, The Vietnam War and Our National Identity, he'll be speaking about and signing the book at Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts on Tuesday, the 24th of February. You can find out more information about that event by going to odysseybks.com. Odysseybks.com. Again, the name of the book is American Reckoning. Christian Appy, a great pleasure to have you on the program and to share your knowledge and expertise. I greatly appreciate having you on the program.
For me too. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Again, you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.